The Linux Night Tech Show is on. Your link to GNU Linux and the latest technology. 2 hours of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter.
Oh, yeah.
Free software, free speech, open technology, and open mic.
I love it.
Now, live from the Linux Link Tech Show studios, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up and take it away.
I think this is where we're supposed to start the voiceover part. We faded down, Dan.
Yeah, where we faded down.
Yeah, I'll just let it go.
Just let it go all the way through
does
the
it
background.
Do something at the end?
No, it just kind of stops.
Just fades out.
Just fades out.
I thought we were going
to. There it is.
I thought we were going to get a 21 gun salute there for a second.
That is the brand new Linux Link Tech Show intro.
And then, yes, it is the same guy who does the Jack Attack intro.
I liked it. And you know what? New year, because technically this would be the first show of our fourth year.
Pretty much, yeah.
Is it?
Actually,
is it really?
Well, wow. If you go by the number
of shows.
If
you want by dates.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
This is our fourth year.
The number of shows, we're at show 157, so the end of the third year would be 156.
We need a vacation.
Yeah, man. Right,
so this would be the fourth.
Columbus is going to be our vacation.
And we made up for those few weeks we had on vacation by going by the LWE shows.
Sure, right.
And then we'll have the Ohio shows coming up. So
I don't think
we still need
so
a vacation.
It's our third year in production with a new, with a brand new intro.
Fourth
the
year.
Third, yeah, it's our fourth year with three new intros, right? Three.
Do a new one every year.
Intros.
Yeah. All right.
Sort of, kind of.
Got an awesome guest on
tonight. Oh, yeah.
What a way to start off the fourth year. Pat, since you always introduce the guests, why don't we let Alan do it this
time? Yeah, Alan, why don't you introduce the guests tonight? You want me to do it? Okay.
He's a retard.
Everyone, I'd like to introduce Brian Bagnall, author of On the Edge, The Spectacular Rise and Fall of Commodore. Brian, welcome to the show. It's a great honor to talk to you.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Woo-hoo. You've written a great book, man. We love it.
You've read the book, eh?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I couldn't put it down, actually. I started reading it, and I just went right through.
Well, see, Pat and Dan read it, but I only got my copy, like, yesterday, so I'm like a third of the way through.
Okay.
But it is pretty damn good, I'll tell you for now.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's a big book too, I should add.
Yes, it is. That's part of the reason why I didn't get done with it yet.
It's biblical proportions.
What is it? The actual text is what, 550 pages around?
It's right there.
Yeah, it's something like that. It was actually originally when I was writing the book, when I finished it, I had it at about 800 pages, literally, and I had to scale it back from there.
Wow. Now, why? I guess the first question is, why did you write a book about Commodore?
Well, first I noticed a few things, like Commodore had quite a following online, and there was I never realized how many computers they sold, actually, and as it turns out, they sold something like 20 million Commodore 64s. And that was, heads and tails above Apple or any of the competition. So I thought, you know, that there's a book that really deserves to be made. I mean, it was a, you know, very popular computer there at the start. And a lot of interesting stories, as it turns out.
Now, I'm assuming, were you a Commodore user?
I was, actually. Yeah, I started, my first computer was a Commodore 64. And I think I had that sometime. It's hard to remember back then, actually, but I think sometime maybe in 1983. Maybe Christmas of 1983 or something, I think I got it.
Yeah, I personally...
And
I started with Commodore. My first three computers were a VIC-20, a Commodore 64, and an Amiga 500. And a lot of people start with Commodore.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's the kind of computer where you can go to, you know, Toys R Us or Kmart, you know, any department store like Sears, and pick one up for a few hundred dollars.
Yeah, it really was. That's sort of what their philosophy was compared to other companies, was they were trying to be the people's computer. You know, like the computer that anybody could afford. Hopefully it'd be easy to use. And, you know, contrast that with IBM, which was the business computer, and contrast that with Apple, which was sort of the, I guess they, I never, like, they always tried to take the name, they were high-end. I didn't take that to mean high-end technologically, just sort of higher prices. The software was always, you know, a little more costly than the Commodore software. So, yeah, Commodore sort of found their niche being the computer that anybody could own, anybody could afford.
So how long did it actually take you to write the book?
Oh, it actually took a long time. I started sometime in 2002, like late 2002. And I did a lot of research. I had a whole stack of Byte magazines going back to, I think, 1975 when it first came out. And sort of used that for the basis of my research for the early period there. I also had a whole bunch of compute magazines, and I just tried to use those to sort of map out what the story of Commodore was. And I wrote maybe 400 pages or so, maybe 400 to 500 pages like that. And then I decided to go in and get the real story and start interviewing people. That was about probably a year later. And I thought I could get the interviews in there in about 3 months and be done with it. But it took basically a whole other year to get that material recorded and transcribed and put in the book. But I think it was, for me, I knew it was worth it. It was definitely worth it to be able to talk to some of those guys.
Now, what we found really remarkable was that you had such, it seems to have such access to the key players of Commodore's glory years. I mean, how were you able to, you know, get a hold of these guys? How did you go about doing that? That seems like it would be a very almost insurmountable hurdle to get the number of people that were key players in Commodore to come forward and speak.
Yeah, it was tough getting a lot of them. They sort of came slowly. The good thing about, you know, people in the computer industry is that they tend to be kind of bleeding edge with everything. And so they all had email addresses, and you could kind of, you know, hop on Google and see what you could find with their names. And, yeah, eventually I think I tracked down Al Charpentier was actually sort of the first one. He's the designer of the VIC video chip. He was sort of the first one that I got a hold of. And I would ask, you know, him, you know, who can he get me in touch with? And I think he got me in touch with Robert Russell, who was very hard to get a hold of by phone, by the way. And got me in touch with a few of those. Chuck Peddle was a real challenge because he's still in the computer industry. And he was working at a place called Celotronics. But I was always just missing him. He was always just coming in or just leaving or whatever, and I could never seem to get a hold of him. But I just kept trying. I must have called him, like, literally, you know, 20 times or something like that before I finally did get a hold of him. And he turned out to be a really good interview and really, like, gave a lot of his time to the book.
So were most of the people that you, when you initially approached them, the people that you interviewed, were they... Did they initially feel like seem eager to talk about the Commodore years? Were they happy that you were doing this project?
I'd say Bill Hurd was one who had no problem telling a story. Like, you know, obviously he had a lot of stories that were pretty interesting to tell. Maybe Bob Yannis, who he designed the SID chip. He was maybe seemed a little reluctant at first, or maybe at times, but he ended up giving quite a bit of good information. The guy, I would say, there was reluctance from Jack Tramiel. He was the big one, and I mean, I really, he's kind of the heart of the Commodore story in a way. And unfortunately, he just wasn't interested.
He's got to be getting up there in age, though, right?
He is, yeah. Not as old as you'd think, probably. He was born in, I think, 1928. I don't know, how old is that? That makes him maybe in his early 70s or mid-70s or something?
Yeah, about 76.
Late 70s? Okay, so he's sort of mid to late 70s, I guess.
1928, well, yeah, no, actually 78, wouldn't he be? 2006,
okay, yeah,
78.
So, I mean, he's fairly old, but he's still, you know, he's probably got a lot of years ahead of him, I would think. But, yeah, I did, I had his address, so I wrote him a few letters. I had his phone number, and I'd phone him, you know, as much as I phoned Chuck Peddle. Just, you know, repeatedly phone him, kind of wake up, give him a call, try calling later in the day, different times. And the one time he picked up the phone, all I heard was, in the background, I heard like a TV set or something going. And it's waiting for someone to say hello or whatever. He just sort of held the phone there for a second and then basically hung up on me. He knew that I was coming after him, by the way, because I talked to his son already, and I asked his son to tell him that I'm trying to get a hold of him. So I think he knew that I was after him, and, you know, he really didn't want to talk to me.
you didn't have the in like you did with Chuck Peddle, because Chuck Peddle is also Canadian, right?
Yeah, Chuck Peddle, well, he's not technically Canadian. His family is Canadian from the Maritimes, and they moved over to Maine, I guess it was, and that's where he was actually born, was in Maine.
Now, Chuck Peddle was one of the pioneers. I mean, he was one of the early chip developers back in the day, right?
Oh, yeah. He was there when the 68 Motorola 6800 was developed. He wasn't there from the start of that project, but he came in to sort of finish it off. How can I get rid of this? Sorry. Okay. So, yeah, he came in at that project near the end, from or in the middle, perhaps, and made a lot of changes. Before that, he was working on the mainframe computers at General Electric. So he was sort of there when all the, not just the personal computer stuff was happening, but, you know, the real computer-type stuff was happening with businesses. And, he helped develop the 6800, and then from there went on to do 6502. And after that, of course, he did the PET computer.
Now, Commodore originally started as a typewriter and a calculator company, correct? Back in the day, they pretty much did typewriters, right?
That's correct, yeah. That's the reason, you know, I mentioned earlier my book was 800 pages. That's kind of the reason it was 800 pages, is because I'd written all this material on the pre-computer Commodore. And, you know, once I had an 800-page book, I kind of had to be pretty selective about what was going to be in the book. And I figured the people who are reading this book are really going to be more interested in the computer story of Commodore rather than hearing about, you know, typewriters and adding machines and that kind of thing. So, yeah, that I cut all that material out, but, I sort of know that story, how that goes.
Now, one of the stories that you mentioned briefly in the book, you were talking about a scandal when Commodore was still very early in its days, when it was still a typewriter company up in Canada. Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, that was known as the Atlantic Acceptance Scandal, and I became very familiar with that, actually, because I've just really lucked out and found at the law library at the University of Manitoba, they happen to have a book that was all about this scandal that happened that I'd never heard about. And what happened was a bank called Atlantic Acceptance basically went bankrupt. And one of the central reasons that they went bankrupt was Commodore. like the old Commodore before they were into computers. And, you know, Jack Tramiel, I don't know what kind of image you got of him in the book, but I guess he's sort of a bit of a wheeler dealer. Not really, let's say, his business ethics aren't too polished, maybe you could say.
From your book and what I've read of him in all the sources, he seemed to be a really shrewd guy, very, very determined, you know, very, very no-nonsense, very, very direct. And if you didn't produce, you know, you got your ass handed to you and you're out the door.
Yeah. If you, apparently, you know, he gave you a chance. It's not like if you screwed up, you were out the door. If you were sort of willing to learn and, because, you know, there was engineers who also screwed up and who also got in a lot of trouble with Jack Tramiel. But, you know, as long as you seemed like you were willing to learn from your mistake, he'd keep you on at Commodore. But if he thought that you were incompetent, or if you made the same mistake twice, because they really were figuring things out for the first time back then, you know, the PC industry was brand new and people were just making things up as they went along, so obviously there were a lot of paths that didn't work out for them. So he would, you know, he would let you screw up, but if you screwed up twice the same way, then you were pretty much out the door.
Yeah, he sounded like a real hard ass, but he seemed to have garnered a lot of respect from just about everybody that you interviewed.
And a lot of loyalty, too. It seemed like the certain people that really liked him, you know, stuck by him.
Yeah, I wasn't sure how much of that was like the Stockholm Syndrome, you know, where you're taken hostage and then you sort of bond with your captor. Like, there may have been an element of that operating as well.
Well, he would send those, what were they called, those people when they screwed up or something, and he'd send them on a little tour. What was that? You had a specific name for that, but they seemed to always come back.
Yeah, it was like a work tour. I wasn't sure if he picked that up from, like, he had come from the work camps in Poland, specifically Lodz, like Lodz. You know, if you messed up there, I think that they did the same thing. They put you on this work tour where you do hard labor for, you know, a week or a couple of weeks or something like that. And I wasn't sure if he saw that happening there and sort of incorporated that into his own business style. Or there's also a Japanese concept called the window seat, where if somebody screws up in the company, they keep you on at the company, but you're not really doing anything actively. You're kind of just sitting there watching it, you know, from the window seat. So it's sort of, I don't know what inspired him to do that, but if somebody screwed up, he would send them on this trip overseas where he'd be kind of ostracized from the rest of the Commodore employees. And then after you served your time, he'd let you back into the fold. So that was one of his business tools, I guess you could call it, for managing people.
Now, on something like that, on a tour like that, would Commodore foot the bill for the person to be relocated over there, or would that be something that would come at the cost of the employee?
Oh, absolutely. I think that was I think Commodore would pay for that. Because you were really doing something. Like, Commodore had operations in Japan and Hong Kong, and they did need people to go out there and do things. I think, like, his own son, Sam Tramiel, if he displeased Jack Tramiel, he'd get the same treatment as the other Commodore employees, and he got sent away to Hong Kong to operate their digital watch division for a while. And, you know, according to Chuck Peddle, the reason he was sent away was because he displeased Jack.
So I kind of get the impression that if you were a family guy, a family man, Commodore really probably wasn't the place for you. But if you were a loner...
Or single, young.
A single guy who had a really strong work ethic, then...
And no,
hey,
no girlfriends.
the Golden Gates of Commodore eagerly welcomed you in.
I would say that's accurate in the sense that it would be difficult to have a meaningful relationship while working at Commodore, probably especially if you're an engineer, because you know, the engineers, a lot of them would end up just sort of sleeping at Commodore, and you know, it's hard to have a relationship when it's like that, or you know, the traveling thing. That was especially hard for people. There's one guy, I can't remember his name, but Chuck Peddle mentioned him, who, you know, he had a wife and he had kids, and Jack sent him away on one of these work tours, and you know, he couldn't even see his own family for like 2 months or something like that, which was pretty painful, obviously.
Now,
so, yeah, it could be hard on relationships.
Now, the very first computer that Commodore was known for was the PET.
Yep.
And that was geared towards more like a business machine, right?
I would say so, yes, because in a lot of ways it was similar to the IBM PC, in that it didn't have you know, fancy sound or fancy color or anything like that, and because of that, you know, people saw it more as a business machine. It was almost like if your computer had color, well then people didn't think it was a business machine; they thought it was a video game machine, and so it actually did have a pretty big impact on the business community in the UK, but not so much in North America.
Now, it seems like almost every single computer that Commodore put out was huge in Europe, you know, especially in Britain and in Germany. And even towards the end, you know, when Commodore was going down, they seemed to be thriving in Europe.
Yeah, that's they actually had a real big name there. Like, I think in North America, you know, a lot of people heard of Commodore and know the name Commodore, but it's not, I don't think the name rings as large as, say, IBM or Apple. Like in Commodore, you know how big the World Cup and things like that are. Well, Commodore sponsored a whole soccer team, and, you know, they had Commodore on their jerseys and things like that. So, yeah, they were really big over there, and, you know, almost like the main, you know, people would turn down a job at IBM so they could work for Commodore.
Now, if you talk about, you know, loyalty, some of the Commodore people are the most loyalist people in all of the computer industry. I mean, even today, there's still bulletin boards, and there's still people that talk about the Commodore. They still do mods to them. It's really amazing when you think about it.
Yeah, I'm amazed at the development that's going on for the Commodore 64 still. Like, I've seen a new operating system for it called Contiki that does, you can, you know, browse the web with it. You can use TCP/IP. It's got, like, a, you know, icon-driven system. That's like a brand new operating system that came out, you know, maybe 3 or 4 years ago or something. And games, people are making games that are really on the level with the kind of commercial games that would be released back in the 80s. So there's, yeah, a real devoted following, and, you know, a lot of people that email me, they really say, you know, that the machine meant a lot to them when they were young, and, you know, it practically raised a lot of them, it sounds like. So, yeah, I think it had a big impact on a lot of people's lives and probably changed the direction of their careers as well.
Well, after the PET, the VIC-20 came out, which was a pretty popular machine. That was the first machine I had. It was pretty limited what you could do with it. It was very basic. Mm-hmm. You know, but the machine that really hit a home run was the Commodore 64. Mm-hmm. There was, what, 20 million sold eventually at the end? After everything was all said and done, 20 million, I think, was the number I heard.
That's the one that's bandied about the most. There's a Commodore employee named Andy Finkel, who, you know, he was right in there the whole time, stayed with Commodore from the VIC-20 days right till the Amiga days. And he estimated between 17 and, I think it was 22 million. And Guinness Book of World Records, they put a number out, something like 30 million, I think it was, or 25 or something. But from what I understand, that's not really the accepted number. I think they're estimating a little higher. And that compares, you know, so people take 20 million, and that compares to 5 million sold for the Apple II computer. So it really did outsell the competition by a lot.
And how many were the Amigas? I've heard 5 million for the Amiga?
Yeah, that's correct. Amiga is about 5 million. VIC-20 was about 3.5 million. Commodore 128. That's a tough one. I think it might have been about 3 million or 4 million or something.
I mean, these are incredible numbers when you think about it compared to what the competition was back in those days, you know, the Apple II, you know, the TRS-80s.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. I didn't have anything to say.
No, speaking of that, what I found really interesting was, it came up a few times in the book, was a comment about how Commodore was selling a really significant number of computers compared to the competition, and particularly Apple would still claim that they were the number one computer in the world.
Right, their advertisements would come out and say the Apple II, the most popular personal computer.
You had the Apple PR machine claiming that that they're number one, they're the greatest, but yet Commodore was beating them, you know, hands down.
Landslide, yeah.
By a landslide, which makes me wonder if, you know, that Apple attitude that has persisted till this day, and whether the PR machine really makes the Apple sound a lot better than it may actually be.
Yeah.
I mean, in your opinion, is that the case?
I would say so. I would think back then, say between the PET computer and the Apple computer, if it was my money, I would probably, just because of the price difference with the PET, I may have gone for the PET. But if I did have the money and it was between the PET and the Apple II, I think I would have went with the Apple II back then. Like, just because it had better color, sound, and that sort of thing. But then, yeah, in the days of the Commodore 64 days, when the Apple II was still selling for like $2,000, and the Commodore 64 was like, I think it came down to $159 or something at one time. You know, then even if the Commodore was $2,000, I think I still would have wanted the Commodore 64 just because it literally had, you know, better sound, better graphics capability, same amount of memory. So, yeah, I think PR and commercials and that do have a lot to do with it. I mean, I see these Apple commercials today about how they say, oh, Apple, it has more color than the competition and stuff like that. But, you know, in 1984, the Macintosh was this black and white computer that was really slow and kind of sad compared to, like, the Amiga and the Atari ST. But somehow their advertising seemed to overcome that, and, you know, nobody noticed that this computer was kind of a little slow, you know?
So you watch, and speaking of that, you watch, like, the movie Pirates of Silicon Valley, and, you know, you watch that, and you get this feeling like, okay, here's this small company that starts off in this garage, and they put together this amazing computer.
And everybody goes crazy.
And everybody goes crazy. And I've heard Steve Wozniak talk about how he, you know, produced color in the Apple and did all this innovative stuff. And yet I'm reading in your book here that, you know, that's not completely accurate, that, you know, okay, the Apple was, you know, a decent computer, but the Commodore outshined the Apple. That it almost seemed like at one point in the book someone had said that Steve Wozniak was almost on the verge of being kicked out of Apple before he finally sat down and they got him to do that disk drive that he so, you know, eagerly produces in his speeches about being the first one to ever do, like, this really unique, fancy thing with a floppy disk drive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's almost a 180.
Yeah, it's like doublespeak or something. Chuck Peddle, you know, he was right there when that was happening, and, you know, he even went to Apple eventually and came back. And so he had a lot to say about, you know, the Steve Wozniak aura that's, you know, been built up, the legend that's sort of been built up. And a lot of that, I think, has to do with a guy named Regis McKenna, who is really the guy who did all the Apple advertising early on. He came over from Intel, I believe it was, and he was responsible for, you know, them having these advertisements that said they were number one and all that, when they were really a very distant third. And they only did become, they actually, you know, maybe it's a case of if you get people to believe it, then, you know, tell them you're number one and eventually you will be number one. Because they did become number one, I think sometime around 1980 when VisiCalc really hit. That was the thing that turned Apple around, really. And Commodore, I guess, never had that. They were originally going to have VisiCalc for the PET first. And there's a little story in the book about how, you know, just basically luck. It was pure luck that Apple got VisiCalc before the PET. And that, and it became known as, you know, the computer that runs VisiCalc, basically.
Now, the man with the money behind Commodore was Irvin Gould. And from what I read in your book, it seemed like he was always keeping a very tight rein on everybody. Even when Jack Tramiel became very successful, you know, he was talking about maybe bringing his sons on to help him run the company. It sounded like Irving was the guy who always said no, and at the end of the day, he was the one who really had the final say.
Yeah, I think that's probably accurate. From what I heard, he didn't seem to say a lot. Like, when he was, you know, he'd come around Commodore once in a while, and he wouldn't try to tell people what direction to go in or anything. But yeah, I think he was sort of this silent guy who was behind the scenes, but really kind of had the final say, you know. I think he probably didn't make a good decision, you know. Like, I think he should have let Jack continue to be Jack, and, you know, because Jack was like a businessman on steroids, basically. He really pushed Commodore, you know, 24 hours a day, really got their engineers moving. And, yeah, I think it was sort of a mistake to say no to Jack in a way. Like, Jack wanted a little bit of the money from the stock, because the stock was doing very well, you know, in the early 80s. Just wanted to, you know, make a stock offering, raise some money, and then do some serious advertising and expand the production and that sort of thing. And Irving was, you know, he was guarding the stock price, basically. Like, he didn't want to dilute the number of stock that was available out there. And it was sort of a short-term thing that, you know, eventually did catch up with Commodore. Because, you know, other companies like Apple, well, they were using their stock, as they should have, as an investment tool to expand Apple. But Irving Gould just had this kind of short-term thing where he wanted the stock price to just keep going up, you know.
It sounded like, you know, every time they were gearing up with a new product, you know, all the engineers were behind it, they wanted to do a push, the marketing people were behind it, that they really never had the resources to really go out there and really do what they wanted to do.
Yeah, Commodore was kind of run on a shoestring budget, in a way, it seems. One of the things that I think they really should have been doing was funding MOS technology and, you know, keeping the 6502 processor line going. You know, like, because everybody knew even back then that the 8-bit processor wasn't going to last forever. You know, you had to have a 16-bit processor coming along sometime. And, you know, after that, they even, you know, reading magazines back then, there's even talk of 32-bit processors. That's in the early 80s. And Commodore, probably because of Irving Gould, I think, just had this attitude that, no, things are good. You know, we're selling lots of computers with this processor. We'll just keep selling them. And I don't think there was a real understanding that you have to continue to evolve the technology.
But even with Jack Tramiel, he was always very clear that he wanted a low-end machine that was geared for the masses. He didn't want something that was really expensive.
That's right, yeah. With the VIC-20, you know, the VIC-20 that you see is not a real sophisticated computer, but he wanted an even more basic computer than the VIC-20, really. and it was sort of the engineers who, on their own initiative, added a few things to the VIC-20 that weren't there, such as the port on the back, the serial port that lets you hook up all these disk drives. That wasn't originally part of the design. I don't even think the original VIC-20 prototype had, you know, BASIC in it, the BASIC programming language. So, you know what, there was an engineer, Bob Yannis, who eventually went on to create the SID chip. He presented this computer to Jack Tramiel that just presented the old VIC-1 chip. And, you know, it was supposed to be just kind of a demonstration of what the chip can do. And Jack Tramiel was like, okay, yeah, let's ship that computer. That computer looks good. And, you know, it wasn't even a real computer. So,
you know, it sounds like a lot of what they were doing, that when it was all said and done, it was they were pretty much amazed that it actually functioned at all, that there were a lot of glitches and a lot of voodoo put in there, and it was flying by the seat of their pants.
You're talking about the VIC or the Commodore 64?
You know, almost all of them. I mean, all the way up from the Commodore, you know, to the Commodore 128, that there was just some things that they plagued with, just hardware issues and design issues and documentation issues when you get to the later models, and that it was, you know, and deadlines that were so horrendous.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's just amazing that they actually functioned.
Those deadlines, you know, they're all, I believe them, I totally believe them, but they're just incredible. Like, I think with the Commodore 64, it was, sometime in September, maybe, that Jack Tramiel said, I want to show this, you know, at CES in 4 months. And, like, or it might even have been less time than that. It might even have been a month or something before CES that he said, you know, I want this computer. And so, yeah, they were working under real time constraints. The general flow I got when I was talking to them was everything seemed to hinge on CES. They always had to have it ready for CES. And so that was probably a good thing in a way, because it, you know, it gave them a definite goal to work for. But, I think there were a lot of, you know, anybody who's programmed a Commodore 64, they know that there's a few bugs in there with, you know, the sound and a few other things. And
it's not a bug, it's a feature.
That's right, yeah.
It was a feature.
And you know what? Sometimes, legitimately, some of the bugs really were features.
There were some bugs in there that would let you do some workarounds in machine language and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That were pretty pretty helpful, you know, some of the stuff with sprites and things. I remember that
stuff.
Yeah,
there was like a bug with the VIC chip, or the VIC-2 chip, where you could display, like, something like 64 sprites on the screen or something, or that may actually have been an intentional feature. But I know there was things with the SID chip, the sound chip, where you could just make incredible sounds because, you know, there was a little bug you could take advantage of.
Sure.
So, yeah, some of those things were kind of neat. Yeah.
Now, the huge success of the Commodore 64... You know, I talked a little bit about, you know, Jack Tramiel was trying to get his sons into the business. It got to the point where Irving Gould fired Tramiel.
Yeah.
And then he left, and he went and he bought Atari after that, right?
Yeah. Whether or not he got fired or if Jack Tramiel kind of walked away seems to be a little bit up in the air. I think he... Like, he himself, in an interview, he said that he kind of walked away. But then I'd heard from Michael Tomchek, who he actually wrote a book about Commodore back in 1984. He says that Jack Tramiel was totally caught off guard and sort of found out while he was flying back in the jet that the board of directors voted him out. So it's like, you know, it's like all these power people... with their, you know, power moves and all that, you never seem to be able to get the true story of what's happening, and it's kind of hard to figure out.
Because all suits lie.
because all suits lie. Well, there's a few good suits probably, but there's a lot of ego involved, and I think a lot of time they're trying to protect their ego.
Now, one of the things about Jack Tramiel was about the things that he used to do. I mean, he burned, besides, you know, pissing people off, he burned a lot of bridges with distributors, suppliers. You know, you mentioned instances where he would order something and make deals with people, and then he wouldn't pay them.
Yeah, that was just incredible to me. I couldn't believe that kind of stuff was going on. And it's funny because you'd kind of think that if you buy something from someone and they deliver you the goods and then you don't pay them, you'd kind of think that you were at the mercy of the person you're buying the goods from. You know, you'd think that they would have a little leverage on you. But Jack Tramiel actually used that to get leverage on them. He'd sort of like say, well, if you give me this price real cheap for these chips, then I'll pay you for the last shipment, you know? And it actually kind of worked for him, apparently, for a limited time. But, you know, as you say, he did eventually burn bridges, and a lot of people just didn't want to do business with him anymore.
So I guess the board of directors of Commodore figured, you know, this guy has taken us as far as he can take us. It's time for somebody else.
I think so, yeah. They were, there was a quote from Irving Gould, I think it was, and he said, okay, Jack Tramiel took us to a $1 billion company. We need somebody who's going to take us to a $10 billion company. And they did start looking around for sort of a replacement for him. I think they never really were able to replace him because he was so, he was such a hands-on manager, and he was, you know, kind of micromanaging the company. And as soon as he disappeared, a lot of, Bill Hurd had a great term for this. He said Jack Tramiel was like the lion who would go in there and cull the herd. You know, like you'd have a lot of people would get hired at Commodore who were just kind of, you know, like any business, they weren't up to standards, or maybe some of them were maybe even incompetent. And he'd come in there and just slaughter those who were the weakest out of the herd. And that kind of kept Commodore strong. And then without Jack Tramiel, Commodore just started ballooning and getting bigger and bigger, and nobody was in there cutting the fat, basically.
So Jack Tramiel got booted. He then went out and basically took a lot of the Commodore people with him. A lot of the Commodore engineers and business people left with him. And then they went and they bought Atari.
Yeah, that was kind of ironic, I guess you could say, because Atari was their big competition back then, and Jack Tramiel basically brought Atari to its knees with the Commodore 64. After he released that, there was you know, the big video game crash. Nobody really wanted the Atari 2600 anymore, or didn't want to play those games because they were starting to show their age, and yeah, Atari was just hemorrhaging money, and Jack Tramiel used that to his advantage, as usual, by purchasing the company really cheap. And yeah, he did some really good moves, I think, with the Atari ST. I think that was a pretty impressive computer. Probably not as good as the Amiga, I don't think, but he gave it a good shot, and he used the same strategies that he used at Commodore, and didn't work for him, obviously, though.
Yeah, made a neat computer, but it didn't go anywhere except for, you know, sitting on a shelf somewhere.
Yeah, these days, yeah.
Now, we talk about the Amiga, you know, the whole Amiga, Atari, Commodore. It was pretty much a real tangled mess. I mean, Amiga started off as an independent company, right?
Yeah, Amiga, they were funded by some dentists from Florida originally, and it was just kind of a small startup. I'm trying to think of the name of the company. It's not coming to me. But yeah, they started off with Jay Miner, who, you know, he's the guy who really did drive the Amiga, and they kind of kept picking up more programmers, more developers, and it actually started out as a console. Like, they wanted sort of a super console, And they also, they wanted it to be a console, a game console that also had a keyboard with it, because there was a keyboard port that they built into it initially. And I think after the video game crash, they said, we're not going to go for the console thing anymore, we're just going to try to make it a straight-up computer. And they developed something really impressive, and Jack Tramiel actually tried to buy that technology for Atari. He gave them a loan, and one of the things about the loan was that if they didn't pay it off by a certain date, Commodore could buy their company really cheap for like $100,000 or something like that. And for a while there, it looked like Atari was going to get Atari very cheap. And that's just the typical Jack Tramiel business move there, where he always seems to get a lot of leverage on other companies and seems to be able to get things really cheap somehow. But that's one time where it didn't work for him. Commodore came in and bought the company under Atari's nose, and the Amiga became the Commodore Amiga.
Now,
was that company's name Hitoro?
Yes.
Yeah, Hi-Toro.
Hi-Toro.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Then they thought maybe Toro, yeah, and then they changed it to Amigo, and then Amiga.
That's right, yeah. They thought it sounded too much like the lawnmower company, Toro.
Uh-huh.
And so, and nobody really liked the name, so they went with Amiga. I don't think Jay Miner liked the name Amiga at first, but eventually, I guess he got used to it and started to like it.
Now, one of the things about Commodore buying Amiga was they wound up buying a company for $24 million, where at one point they probably could have got it for $4 million. And this was, I guess, the result of the bidding war with Atari and Jack Tramiel. So they wound up paying a lot more money than they could have initially.
I was getting that from Robert Russell. When they needed an engineer to go down there and survey the company and figure out, you know, whether or not they wanted to buy it, they sent down Robert Russell. He was one of the engineers on the Commodore 64. And, he told them, yeah, this company looks great. Thought they were just going to buy the technology, like just the use of the maybe the graphics chips or... Yeah, the chipset for a computer, I think, was the only thing they wanted. And then, he thought it would, you know, he said he thought it would be for $4 million. And then he found out, you know, I guess he was at a board meeting with Irving Gould and the rest of the board members. And he walked out of that meeting. And the next day he found out, yeah, they bought it for like $25 million or something. And he was just aghast, basically. You know, he said, well, if you gave us that money, we could have developed you a computer, you know, twice as good as that. So I don't think Commodore got a good deal when they bought the Amiga. Well, yeah, they got a good deal because it was a great groundbreaking computer, but they did overpay, I would think.
It was a phenomenal machine. It came with basically three processors, right? And the graphics capability was incredible.
Yeah, it had all these different processors where, you know, instead of relying on the central processor to do everything, it broke up all the different tasks and left the central processor free, basically. So even though you'd have like an Amiga at 2 megahertz or whatever, 5 megahertz, it was actually, in reality, it actually performed a lot better than other machines and had great graphics and multitasking and all kinds of stuff.
But at the end of the day, they didn't spend much on marketing at first. It really took a while to get it going.
Yeah, I was around back then when they launched. They launched it in 1985, and I mean, I distinctly remember seeing commercials for the Macintosh, and they really, you know, Apple, to their credit, really did know how to advertise. They knew how to get that aura around their computer and make people think that they really wanted that machine, and. I don't remember Commodore really doing any noticeable advertising in North America. You know, I know they did do some TV commercials, but I think they were pretty few and far between, and I don't think they were particularly well made either. So it just didn't. I think they just failed with their advertising. R.J. Michael, he said Commodore kind of unadvertised the Amiga, was the way he put it.
I mean, eventually it did sell, especially in Europe. It was a huge machine.
I think it really started selling when they made the Amiga 500, because they kind of Commodore kind of went back to their roots and started making a machine that people could afford and was also, you know, technologically superior to what was out there. Like, I think the Amiga was unquestionably superior to the Macintosh. The Macintosh was like, it was a nightmare with, you know, swapping disks all the time.
It was black and white originally too, right? It was. I remember it was black and white.
Yeah, the Macintosh, you know, had, was black and white. They'd kind of simulate different shades of gray by having little checkered pixels on the screen, and it just kind of looked, you know, especially games and stuff, just looked horrible. And you know, the Amiga was like, I think at least, you know, like 5 or maybe more years ahead of its time, basically. Had a great operating system. And yeah, I think it was. I think it really kind of caught on when they did the Amiga 500, because that was almost like, even though it wasn't compatible with Commodore 64, it almost seemed like a spiritual successor to it. And yeah, people bought a lot of that. And they also bought the Amiga 2000, which had there's a thing called Video Toaster that was really driving it. They sort of found a niche market with the digital video market.
There are some of those toasters still in operation today.
Oh, I was blown away that they were using those, you know, Amigas and video toasters to do the special effects for, like, Star Trek Voyager. You know, like, I thought the Amiga had long since died, but apparently it was doing, you know, cutting-edge graphics on television and stuff.
Babylon 5?
And Babylon 5, yeah, that's another one. And Back to the Future 2, they did some special effects with that.
So after Tramiel left, they brought in Thomas Rodigan, who was a Pepsi executive, right?
Yeah, Thomas Rodigan, actually directly after Tramiel, they brought in a guy, guy from the steel industry, and I've heard a lot of things about him. He was, you know, a nice guy, and I think people got along with him, and he was the guy who was on board when they brought in the Amiga. I think he kind of made the decision to get the Amiga, you know, probably on the advice of his engineers. But, you know, even though he made a good decision there, I think, he really was kind of not the guy that should have been there. And after him came Thomas Rodigan from Pepsi. I think he, you know, Apple just got John Sculley from Pepsi. And, you know, Pepsi was this hot company. And I think, you know, Irving Gould wanted sort of the same thing Apple had, so we got Thomas Rodigan, who actually turned out to be pretty good for Commodore and really seemed to be steering it in the right direction, I think.
Yeah, he was there. He turned things around, you know, for a couple of years. It wasn't looking too good. He made the company profitable. Things were looking up. You know, the Amiga started picking up in sales. And then Irving Gould, you know, the Eagles, you know, took a hold again, and he canned them.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't... I don't know exactly what happened there. I did, you know, I got to interview Thomas Rodigan, and there was, yeah, some sort of clash of personalities there, I guess. And, you know, they ended up escorting, like Thomas Rodigan, I guess he was kind of told that he was not to come on property or something like that. And he came to Commodore anyway, you know, even after he'd been canned, and went into his office. And then the security guard showed up and basically escorted him out back to the parking lot. So there was kind of a little power play there or whatever going on. And obviously Thomas Rodigan lost out.
And then who they bring in after that?
Oh, boy, there was a lot of people in between there. Harold Copperman was one guy. Few others, and then there, I think sort of the most notable one was the last one they brought in was a guy named Mehdi Ali, and I think Mehdi Ali was actually kind of central in getting Thomas Rodigan booted out, and none of the people I talked to had anything good to say about Mehdi Ali, because he came from sort of this financial background, and you know, he thought he could just go into this computer company and run it, and he, I think he kind of ended up just running it into the ground.
Yeah, and it seems like towards the end, Gould was more into just giving himself a high salary and just bleeding the company, it seemed like. You know, all the projects got shut down.
Really strange stuff happening at the end of Commodore's life. Almost, you know, I don't know if you've seen that movie, Hudsucker Proxy?
Yep.
Yeah, where it's like they're trying intentionally to ruin the company because they're selling the stock short. It almost seems like that. It seems like Irving Gould and Mehdi Ali were maybe selling the stock short or something, because the decisions they were making seemed like it was almost intentional to ruin Commodore.
So, in your opinion, if the company wasn't plagued by the constant Commodore curse and they were able to, you know, continue on based upon their history, do you think that they would have been a serious contender in today's market, or would they have inevitably failed?
I think if, after the Commodore 64 was released, I think if they had just had competent management, like not even spectacular management or above average management, but just kind of, you know, maybe IBM type management, I think they would have done okay if they could have extended the Commodore 64 line. Because they had a user base there that was huge and very willing to buy an upgrade to the Commodore 64 as long as it was compatible with all their old software. And I think they could have, if they had got that one thing right, I think they could have rode that chain, you know, all the way up. They would have used Geos. I don't know if you've ever heard of that operating system, Geos.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, that one, I mean, that was impressive back then, and it would have continued to evolve as the hardware evolved. I think they would have been like the Apple today if they could have kept the Commodore 64 going. But
that would have been cool. And you think it would have been an offshoot of the Amiga type of stuff?
Well, the Amiga, they were starting from scratch in terms of a user base. Mm-hmm. I mean, Commodore had some loyalty, and they had people willing to, you know, take a chance on a Commodore computer and buy an Amiga. And it was a great computer, too, which, of course, helped. But, going before the Amiga, I think if they just could have somehow extended the life of the Commodore 64, I think they would have gone somewhere. They could have also, if they had done things right with the Amiga, they could have been the Apple today, I think. They could have been where Apple's sitting today, definitely.
You know, because that's one of the interesting things about that time period is, you know, looking back, you see all these different systems, the Commodores, the TI-99/4A, the Apples, and then come the IBM clones. And prior to, like, the IBM clones, I mean, all these systems had, like, a personality and a following behind them. And they all fell pretty much by the wayside, and what we have now is the Apple and the IBM clones, mm-hmm. The x86 architecture. And when you look at between the two, you look and you say, wow, Apple has this, like, phenomenal personality behind it. And then the other side of the system, what they call generally a PC, is just, a gaudy, you know, box in most cases, that you just have your generic hardware in. And the market doesn't seem to want to support more than, you know, one system with personality and a bunch of clones. Do you think that Commodore, had, if it would have succeeded, would have knocked Apple out of the running?
They definitely could have, because Apple had a lot of, had a soft underbelly. They had a lot of weak points. I think, you know, Apple's biggest weak point was, their prices for everything were, like, you know, double what they should have been. And, you know, Commodore really took advantage of that in the 80s with the Commodore 64 and kind of laid waste to a lot of those other computers. I don't know if you remember this, but there was a time, I think, maybe around 1994 or 1995, you know, Commodore went out of business in 1994. Well, next year, Apple was basically going out of business. They didn't have enough money to keep operating. Their stock was pitiful. You know, it crashed. I think it was like I don't know what, a dollar or something, which is basically, you know, death to a stock.
Uh-huh.
And Bill Gates came in with his billions of dollars and gave Apple the big, you know, $100 million loan or whatever it was that they needed. And, you know, to his credit, Steve Jobs also came back and kind of rescued the company and, you know, brought it to where it is today. So, yeah, Apple easily could have went out of business there if a few key things didn't happen. And, you know, maybe Commodore could have filled that void if they could have held on a little longer.
Now, Apple and Microsoft, in some communities, have a very negative image. They're considered harsh, very competitive, closed, and some of us might say evil. You know, questionable ethics, business practices. yeah. Had Commodore succeeded, do you think that they would carry on similar business practices that Apple and Microsoft carry on now?
Well, it depends which Commodore you're talking about. Like, if you're talking about the Jack Tramiel Commodore, well, you know, Jack Tramiel was Darth Vader, and Bill Gates was like Luke Skywalker, basically.
Apple. I am your back father. Then.
And yeah, actually, there was a time where Jack Tramiel was going to buy Apple. You know, like there was actual negotiations back in, I think, 1976 or 1977, where it was going to be the Commodore Apple. So yeah, that he could have been the father of Apple, really.
And then later on, Commodore was shopping around. They were considering selling Commodore to Apple.
Yeah, that's a funny turn of events there, where it was Thomas Radigan who approached Apple, and you know, I guess he wanted to see if they could use some of the Amiga technology in the Macintosh, because the Macintosh was black and white back then, and it could have used a lot of the features that the Amiga had. But I think what really happened there was that Apple had Macintosh technology in the pipeline that they were getting ready to release, and because you know the Macintoshes essentially did make that transition to color, that one didn't go through.
That's the Apple theme song, right?
I guess they're all a little bit evil, eh?
Yeah, you know, I was just impressed with how ruthless that Commodore was in the early days. If there was a competitor that they could drive out of business or gobble up, man, they spared no expense getting them, taking them down.
Yeah, there were things in there that I was actually told a few things that I wasn't sure I couldn't corroborate them, eh? And so I didn't put them in the book. But yeah, there were. There were even worse things. One thing I heard the Commodore did was they were supplying Atari with their chips. And, Moss Technology was owned by Commodore, and Moss Technology supplied the Atari 2600 cartridges with the ROM chips. And I heard that, they were direct competitors. And here's one competitor, Commodore, supplying Atari. And you really don't want, if you're Atari, you don't want that situation if Jack Tramiel is at the helm, because he's going to really play with you. And he, one Christmas season, you know, Atari was doing great, selling so many cartridges, and apparently Commodore kind of held back on some ROM chips that they needed, and that really kind of hurt Atari. And there were other practices like that I'd heard, and I just, if I couldn't corroborate it, I didn't put it in the book, you know, so...
Now, having done all the research, you know, having lived through it and then done the research, did that change your opinion of Commodore's place in computing history after, you know, from when you started the book to when it was finished? Did your opinion of Commodore's place change?
Not negatively. Like, I was surprised at how ruthless, they could be. But yeah, no, I actually, you know, after doing the research, I find them even more interesting, you know, because there's all these events that happened that I had no idea about. And, a lot of crazy things, like, you know, and that there's that one point in the book where you know, employee actually takes Jack Tramiel hostage with a knife. You know, things like that. They're kind of dark and kind of scary, but yeah, just a lot of stuff happening.
So here's what I really want to know, right? Like, you have an incredible amount of information in this book. It's really, really in-depth and detailed. You know, it goes into the chip making and the whole bit. What I want to know, and you said you had even more, right? What I want to know is give us some kind of, give us some tidbits and some insight on what kind of stuff didn't make the cut. What are the interesting tidbits on what you left out?
Oh, I left a lot of stuff out with Bill Hurd.
Because you know, we're just going to recommend that everybody go out and read this book. So they're going to see what's in it, but we want to know what you didn't have in it. You know,
well,
tantalize us a little bit.
Okay. You want like the sex and violence kind of stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
That's what we do the
Bill
show
Hurd,
for.
You know, if you guys can get Bill Hurd to interview on your show, you'll have a real entertaining hour or whatever. In the book, he was this guy who was, you know, he admits he was alcoholic, but he was also a fantastic engineer. The stuff that I left out with him, and he would have been okay with me putting it in there, were sort of his escapades. He was quite the man. Let's just put it that way. I left that kind of stuff out. I didn't think. I don't know. It was interesting, but it was kind of soap opera type stuff, where, you know, there were a lot of relationships going on at Commodore, because there were, you know, it wasn't a male only club, Commodore. There were women there too, and. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe that's all I'll say about that. I'm kind of chickening out. I don't want to tell any of Bill Hurd's story. If you get him on and he wants to tell those stories.
Don't want to get in trouble, do you?
I'm betting that he's not listening to the show. Go ahead.
Well, Bill Hurd, he's punched a few people in his time, too, as you probably read. And I met him personally, actually, last year. He took me out for lunch.
Did he punch you?
You know, did he punch you, too?
Oh, I was a little bit worried, because I made sure that I didn't give him the book before I met with him. I gave it to him and then got the heck out of there, you know, just in case he didn't like some stuff. But, you know, I'd like to have lunch with him someday, too, and so I don't want to poison the well here. But, yeah, if you guys get him on the show, he'll have, and he wants to, he'll have a lot of interesting stories for you.
That would be really cool.
And there's a... That Chuck Peddle was the other guy who had a lot of stories that were really interesting. And, you know, I couldn't verify some of them, so I didn't put them in. And I don't want to mention them on the radio show either, you know, because that's still spreading possibly false information around. But, yeah, there was a few things that were kind of surprising that I heard from him as well.
Now, Brian, what was your favorite Commodore program?
Game or what?
Anything. Game, application. What do you like?
Well, I was really young when I was using the Commodore 64, so it was mostly games with me. And I really liked Maniac Mansion. That's sort of the one game that, you know... And looking back on a game like that, like, here's 64 kilobytes of memory in the whole computer. And, like, that's not even enough to... run a watch these days, it seems like. And, you know, they had these games that were so in-depth. I would say that's my favorite.
Good
in terms of applications.
Good sound, all kinds of stuff.
Oh, great sound. There's people today who still write songs for the SID chip, and there's actually a whole movement of people who take old SID songs from games and they convert them into MP3s. Like with full instrumentation, you know, a lot of techno music and that sort of thing.
Yep.
It's just incredible what this did. Yeah.
My all-time favorite Commodore game was on the Amiga. It was the Defender. Was it Defender of the Crown?
Oh, yeah.
That was a good game.
Yeah, a lot of people. A lot of people remember that one, yeah.
You were basically this knight, and you went around, you know, attacking your enemies and getting the girl, and it was a great game. It was just a lot of fun to play, I remember.
My favorites were my favorites were in the 64 and the 128, the Bard's Tale series.
Those were good.
Oh yeah.
Now that was some fun back then.
Bard's Tale. That's Brian Fargo, I think, is the guy who created Interplay. They're the company that made Bard's Tale, and he actually did. Brian Fargo actually did a remake of the Bard's Tale for the Xbox in 2004, called the Bard's Tale.
That's cool.
So yeah, that's. I don't think it was a huge hit when he re-released it, but it's definitely a favorite of a lot of people.
I didn't have a Commodore. I had a TI.
I'm sorry for you. I feel sorry for you, Dan.
You want me to give you a Commodore now, Dan?
But I,
you
can, I had a friend who had a Commodore, and I was a big Conan fan, and apparently there was a Conan game for it.
I have that, yeah.
And I wanted
to
go over and play it, and he showed it to me, and then he wouldn't let me play it. We ended up playing Bruce Lee the rest of the afternoon.
Bruce Lee was a good game, too, though.
It's because you want
to. You guys remember a game called Barbarian, where you're two sword fighters and you had to chop the other guy's head off?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, that one is actually, if you're a Conan fan, that game is actually, like, they call it Barbarian, but it's probably supposed to be Conan the Barbarian.
Right.
It's got the same, it's, you know, basically Arnold Schwarzenegger fighting there, the same music as the Conan movies. It's, so if you like Conan, there's your game.
I'm going to have to dig out my Commodores now so I can... I probably have these games. I bet I do.
Now, you can run a lot of these old programs with emulators. There's emulators out there for Linux and Mac and Windows, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the emulation scene is huge. There's even emulators for video game systems like the Xbox.
Yep.
Got to try that out. And you can download these games, right? They're out there.
Yeah, it's sort of a gray area in terms of whether or not you're breaking the law by downloading them. Because I think a lot of the publishers have said, well, if the publisher's gone out of business, I'm pretty sure it's okay to download them. You know, Electronic Arts and Activision, those companies are still going, so I don't know if they care if you download their games or not. Definitely a big, underground movement with that, though.
You know, speaking of games, I have a question for you. One of the quotes that really stuck out to me in the book was from Charles Winterbull, who said, Commodore considered themselves a serious computer company, and serious computer companies don't put out games. And that was almost verbatim the reason why my dad didn't get me a Commodore 64, because he said it was basically a game.
Because he didn't love you.
Yeah, and he said, I'm going to get you a TI, because that's not a game. And if you want to play games, you got to program them yourself. Was that the attitude back then that, you know...
That was right before he locked them in the closet.
That's right.
That was held by, you know, a lot of people, that if you want a computer or a serious computer doesn't play games, it's strictly for business. Which is, you know, almost that's almost the opposite today, because you're looking at the high-end machines, you're looking at gaming machines.
I think if your computer could do really good graphics and really good sound back then, people didn't think it belonged in the business place. And, I mean, now that's totally changed, where, especially in terms of the multimedia that you can do with computers, like with videos and... conferencing, you know, right now I'm talking to you through Skype. You know, you need a pretty good multimedia machine to do those sort of things. But yeah, back then it was like it was almost a bad thing, it seemed like, to have color. I'm sure your dad cared for you. Did it work? Did his little plan work? Did you end up doing a lot of programming and stuff?
On the TI, I did. And then when I hit puberty, I threw it away.
You're the right thing. Yeah.
No, I actually managed to sneak some games in eventually, and but no, it pretty much did work. I had to learn a lot of programming on the TI.
Yeah, Texas Instruments was Commodore's nemesis early on, actually, because they were competing for calculators, and TI kind of ruined Commodore by putting out these really cheap and good calculators. And Commodore was actually kind of on the financial brink, ready to go out of business there. So when Jack Tramiel turned things around and beat the TI computer, that was kind of probably a pretty big moment for him, I would think.
Yeah, weren't they copping the speech capabilities from the TI there for a little bit?
They did look to the speak and spell stuff. They hired the speak and spell programmers, who were brilliant guys, apparently. And they put the speech function into one of the Plus 4 computers, I think. And they also released a cartridge, something like Magic Speech or something. So, yeah, there's a little bit of mixing of the engineers there.
I remember Sam on his on the Commodore.
Oh, yeah.
You guys got to remember Sam.
I remember my 300-baud modem on the Commodore 64.
Hello, my name is Sam. My voice is at your command. Remember that. That was cool.
I forgot all about that.
That was the shit back then, you
back
know?
Back then, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that was very memorable. I remember using that program to call, do prank calls on my teachers.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and Mission Impossible, I think the game is called, where it says, stay a while, stay forever. That was pretty memorable, mm-hmm. too. Mind-blowing that a computer could talk.
That was awesome back in the day.
And you know what? It's come so far.
In 64K. Yeah. In 64K, that's what kills you, you know?
Yeah.
You have to stop and think.
I loved it when it would hit a
word.
Like,
it's
love
like a music file is like 5 megabytes, and that's compressed.
Right.
You know? Like, how did they do anything back then?
Yeah, I love it when it would used to come upon a word it couldn't say, so you'd be like, have a nice day, you B-A-S-T-A. it was tough to get it to say all the words you wanted it to say.
What was it with the... What is it with kids, as soon as they get something like that, they want to try out words? Because I'm sure every kid did that.
You know what? It's not just
probably,
with the
that's
kids.
That's probably why it didn't say those words.
It wasn't just the kids, because you had wrote that the engineers, as soon as they got their hands on it, were doing that.
That's right, yeah. They were trading insults with it, apparently.
Yeah.
It's called testing, Dan.
Yeah.
That's so. Right.
That's what you wanted to say, curse words. Profanity.
So, Brian,
that's how you check for enunciation and consonants and stuff like that.
Yeah. So, Brian, what do you do professionally? You're a Java programmer?
I'm a Java programmer. I'm a certified Java programmer, if that means anything. And, I work on the Legos project, which is where we're trying to port... we have ported a Java virtual machine onto... the Lego RCX brick. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of
those. Those are like uh-huh. those little Lego robots, right?
That's correct, yeah. And they just released a new brick called the Lego NXT. And that one's got a ton of memory. It's got, well, for as far as these things go, it's got, like the old RCX had 64 kilobytes. This one's got 256 kilobytes. So we're going to try to improve what we did before. And I'm thinking somebody's probably going to put Linux on the NXT brick one of these days, too.
Yeah,
I keep
now you're
hearing,
talking.
Like, yeah, I hear Linux is like on, somebody put Linux on their watch or something, so, you know, I can see it going on this.
Cool.
That'll only make it better.
Yes, Linux is pretty neat.
So, have you written anything else besides On the Edge?
Yeah, I wrote a few Java books before, and I actually did a book on the... like programming the Lego RCX. Kay Horseman is the guy's name who does the core Java series, and he put my book in his core series of books.
Those are good books. That's how I learned how to program Java, with those Horseman books.
Yeah, I found his books to be really good too.
Very good.
So I was honored that he would put, you know, a book on Lego programming in his core series, and it worked out pretty well.
So do you use Linux at all?
I'm not like a knowledgeable on Linux, but I'm getting things set up for what we're doing on the Lego NXT, because we need to use the GNU compiler, like to do some development for the ARM7 processor.
Uh-huh.
So I'm sort of getting a development environment set up in Linux right now, and... you know, I'm going to use that. I've used it before a little bit, but I'm not really a very knowledgeable guy in Linux. But looks good. I mean, it's free, and it's powerful, and keeps getting better. So I kind of can't wait to really get in-depth with it.
Well, I'm gonna give you a secret tip that's going to make you sound like a pro when you're talking Linux to other Linux geeks. You just tell them that Vi is better.
That Vi is better.
Vi is better.
Vi
is better. That's the best one. They say what editor? You say Vi.
Okay.
Nothing else matters.
So I sort of say that and then like walk away.
Yep. There you go. You just
slap
say it
them first.
Say it and walk away. You know. And no, if they say Emacs, then you slap them.
You slap them anyway. You slap them right across the face and walk away.
Can I ask you, is Ubuntu, is that any good? Is that the way to go?
That's nice. Really good, actually. If you're just starting out with Linux, that's a fine one to start with. You know, it's very easily configured and works on a lot of standard run of the mill newish sort of hardware and you know, without any problems whatsoever.
It's based on Debian, man.
Mm-hmm.
Can't go wrong there.
Okay, good. That's the one I got. I just like the name Ubuntu. It sounds so cool.
It's good. It's a nice distribution.
It's a great distribution.
If we go around the room here, I think three of us are running it right now, no? Well, you're running Slack on your laptop?
Yep.
I'm running Kubuntu, which is the KDE desktop with Ubuntu. Alan's running Ubuntu.
Just Ubuntu, yeah.
Dan on his workstation.
Running Arch.
He's got Arch Linux.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is... Actually, we've talked to a guy from Arch. He's Canadian. Judd Vinay from Vancouver.
Okay.
Actually, Victoria.
So everybody we talk to is Canadian. Why don't we just move there? We know so many Canadians, man. When do we get our official Canadian press pass or something?
Why don't we get dual citizenship?
Really? They should give us a... We should have a little Canadian citizenship.
We don't have to worry about the heat in the room here.
Now you go.
I wouldn't mind becoming an American citizen, actually, because I hear there's low taxes and stuff there.
That's true. You guys have socialized everything, so you pay through the nose and taxes.
Hey, we'll trade you a link for a Brian Bagnell.
Yeah, I'll go up there.
Maybe
free healthcare.
Maybe Canada could be. If we could become like the 51st state or something, that would be fine with me.
I think you're the only Canadian who thinks that.
You already are. You
probably,
just don't know it.
But are you Sun employee? Do you work for Sun Microsystems?
I don't know. There's the, like, Sun's pretty positive about seeing a Java virtual machine put on, like, the Lego stuff. And there's a guy, Simon Ritter, who works for Sun, who's, you know, he uses that for a little demonstration of Java wherever he goes. They're pretty positive about it.
We got to check that stuff out, man. It sounds like real interesting, fun stuff to play with, man.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a toy, but it's... It's pretty powerful, really, when you get down to it.
Well, we'll check it out. Maybe we can have you on again.
You guys have anybody have kids over there?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay,
no,
well,
we don't have children in America.
Oh. You just, like, clone each other, eh?
That's it.
Well, if you want something good for your kids, I highly recommend the Lego NXT.
Oh, well, we're geeks, you know. We have to have that for ourselves first, you know.
I have the original mine.
See, there you go. Ellen already has one. There you go.
I don't think I've never really used it a whole lot, though.
Well, shame on you.
Well, the problem is that, you know, I was living in an apartment when I bought it, and with cats, you know, you start to build something. If you can't finish it all at once, the cats steal all the parts.
Hide pieces on you, yeah.
It never worked out really well.
And they use it as a litter box.
I know what you're talking about.
I think that we could check them out a lot better if you would just send us a few. You know, you just.
I'll play with it, man. I know Java. I like to play with robots.
If I could send you,
yeah, you gotta have like demo models there somewhere, right?
You're talking to the wrong guy. I don't have any clout with Lego.
We gotta talk to the Lego people.
Yeah, talk to the Lego people.
Yeah, those Mindstorms are. You know,
they're not cheap, right?
Compared to the other Lego products.
They're pretty expensive, right? The kits?
There's no cheap Lego products anymore.
Oh, you used to get like Legos for like $4 or $5. You know,
yeah, but you only get two in a plastic bag. Yeah, you know?
I mean, with the Mindstorm, it's like $150, $300.
It's like $300.
I think the American price might be $250 or something.
Which, baby.
Well, I mean, you look at, say, what an iPod costs, and I mean... I don't know. I think it's not a bad deal.
I'm not saying it's a bad deal, but
it depends what you're interested in, I guess. I mean, there's not a lot of memory, so you kind of maybe wonder what it is you're paying for exactly. But you know, it comes with a lot of, it comes with like servo motors and lots of sensors and stuff. So for me, I think it's a good deal.
Next week, Pat will come in and he'll have sold his laptop that he just got.
Yeah, from MindStores.
Yes.
I would totally be into that. I have a little son, and he's a little older, man. Definitely.
Oh yeah, yeah. If you want him to follow in your footsteps technologically, you can't go wrong with that.
Well, Brian, we thank you for coming on the show. Maybe we'll talk to you again about, you know, the Lego Mindstorms. That'd be something I'd be interested to check out. You know, you're more than welcome to come back in the future. You know, we really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about your book. It's a fantastic book, and I recommend it to everybody. You know, check it out. It's a good read, really enjoyable. Went through it really fast.
Great. Yeah, it was great talking to you guys.
Okay, yeah, thanks a lot. Thanks
great
for coming on.
And, you know, I'm waiting for that TI-99-4A book to come out.
You may have to write that one yourself.
That'd probably be a pamphlet, not a book.
A pamphlet.
All right. Thanks a lot, Brian. Thank you for coming on.
All right. Take care, you guys.
Take care.
Thank
you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And there
that was Brian.
We go.
Awesome book. Definitely read it if you get a chance.
Yeah, good book. Yeah. Like, I'm not even done with it yet, but I'm really into it.
I'm surprised you didn't try to finagle a review copy off of somebody instead of paying for a book.
Well, I try, you know, but they just people are not forthcoming with that kind of stuff anymore, you know? Just don't understand.
Parents just don't understand.
Man, Commodore will always have a special place in my heart, man. Grew up on those machines. Good stuff.
Me too. I used them until I started using Linux, you know?
Has a special place in a box in the cellar for me.
I think it's in my parents'
attic.
Speaking
of that, I have some more Jaguar stuff for you.
Oh, cool.
I got a bunch of games. Some more controllers. There might even be a whole other system in that box. I don't know.
How many games and shit did you have, man?
One of each.
I'm up to like two full boxes.
I had an Atari, I had an Intellivision, a ColecoVision, a Nintendo, a Jaguar, all this crap, but I never had a Commodore 64.
That's
which was
amazing.
All in the same price range, you know?
Yeah, I was going to say, it was all about the same.
Those machines were really pain in the ass to program. You had to use like peaks and pokes, which referenced like different sections of memory, and it was
that's
very
your phone this time.
And it was very hokey to do certain types of programming. Once you got up into the Amiga, it was much easier and it was a lot more robust. And they were fun though.
I loved programming on my Commodore 64. I thought that was awesome. And moving from that back and forth to like the BASIC on the Apple II series was a piece of cake. You know, and I had to program on the Apple IIs in school and high school and stuff like that.
You know what? You're
I'm too old. I didn't have that shit in high school for me.
Programming on the Commodores at home. Go out and play some good games on it, man. And that, I do have that Conan game, by the way. I do have. We'll have to hook it up sometime. Check it out.
If you're nice, I'll let you play.
I remember that.
I'll come over to play it. He'll
play
be like,
it,
here
shit.
It is.
I have like 15 systems. We can set it up and everybody can play at the same time.
That'd be cool,
over
man.
There, he'll be like, yeah, here it is. And then he'll turn it off and he'll be playing Bruce Lee the rest of the day.
Right.
Got to check out the emulators to get that running, man. They're out there. So I know Judlin was posting on his blog about it for a bit.
Right.
So I might have to go over there and check out what he was using.
Well, they have those, and they have those like those joysticks out now, right?
Yeah,
with the games built in them,
right?
But you can tap into those things and add like a keyboard, and they have a serial connection for you can add a Commodore disk drive to it, and the whole bit. They're pretty freaking cool, man. To say, I haven't done it yet, but I do have the damn joystick to try. You know,
I got the joystick too. Supposedly, if you open it up, it's all marked.
Right.
All the shit is marked in there. You just have to solder to it.
Right. You just, and they have, yeah, the little the solder tab.
You can do that with that little Atari, the 2600 box that they're putting out now. You can actually put the cartridges into that one.
Yeah, but you have to find
the cartridge board.
You know, probably could use something else for that, but good luck finding one.
Remember when they tried to have a comeback for the Commodore 64? And the commercial for it went like, it's the Commodore 64. Your friends will be knocking down the door. Remember that? Anybody? No.
Don't remember.
All right.
The only Commodore commercials I remember was William Shatner.
Bill Shatner with the VIC-20. Yeah. I remember that, too.
I remember those.
I remember that, too. That was a good commercial.
Was he singing Lucy in the Sky?
Mr. Tambourine Man?
I have a question that's unrelated to the Commodore, but it is related to Myth TV. And your article...
Here we go again.
It's not out yet, is it?
Yes, it is. It came out
last Friday. You can ask him about Myth TV. He's not going to stop talking about it for another year.
Linux Pro Magazine. Linux Pro Magazine in the United States. Internationally, it's Linux Magazine.
I'll have to go pick it up.
It's the same one that Dan was in a few months ago.
Okay. What is the topic of the... It's not the virtualization one, is it?
No, it's the one after that.
Okay, because I was at Borders and they didn't have it.
Yeah, it's not... I was in Borders, too, the other day, and they didn't have it yet.
Yeah, and then I looked at the back.
Yeah, it's supposed to be out a few days, right? It should be out.
It was out Friday in Europe.
Because it's the international one, so it takes a couple more days
for another month.
No,
it'll be here in a couple days.
A week or two. Yeah. Probably within a week.
Be here in a couple
days. I remember when mine came out, and I had to wait for like a month before it hit the United States. Anyway, we have digital cable, which requires a box.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And to get my TiVo to work, I had to get one of the IR...
You have to get a blaster.
IR blaster.
Yeah.
Now, the question I have for that, and it would be the same thing I would assume with a Myth TV
Myth box, you need that as well.
Before, we just had the regular cable here, mm-hmm. and you could watch the TiVo and then, you know, switch right back over to the TV. That would automatically allow you to, you know, watch a different channel. Or the VCR would allow you to watch a different channel. And the way it was actually set up is you could record... something on the TiVo, record something different on the VCR, and then watch TV on another channel.
Mm-hmm. You ported it three different ways.
Right, but you can't... But now, because of that digital... The box, I can't do that.
You can only do one channel, yeah.
Is there a way around that?
You get another box.
That's what I thought. You'd have to get another box.
Sometimes the digital ones will still be analog on the lower channels.
Yeah, I was told that you can split off...
Yeah, but you only get like 2 through 13.
Right, and I thought, well, what's the point of that if you're not going to get... I mean,
it's like your local stations.
You're not going to get like Cartoon Network or...
No, you won't get any of the digital stuff.
Which really sucks.
Yeah, even though they tell you have to have... Now, if your TV tunes in cable channels, you'll get a little bit more, but not a whole lot more. You won't get the digital tier.
Well, see, I'm not so much concerned about the digital tier, but, I mean, is there a difference between... standard Cartoon Network, and is there a digital tier Cartoon Network?
Yeah, they have like a, what is it? Boomerang, I think, is their one.
Oh, I think
they have an anime one too, but I'm not totally sure what the name of it is.
Is that EWAM?
That may be it. I know it's not on any of the ones up here.
Because there's a channel down there that's just called EWAM, I think it is, and it has Street Fighter and Demon Sword Kyo. And a whole bunch of other ones. I was like, yeah. And I started TiVoing them. I'm like, but I'm not going to be there. I have to watch them, damn it. And I was just curious. But
any of those boxes, whether it's digital cable or satellite, you're going to have to build an IR blaster. And basically what that does, it plugs into your serial port. And basically what it is you're tricking the receiver thinking that it's receiving a signal from your remote.
Yeah, from the remote. That's the way the TiVo works, too.
And basically what you wind up doing, you can buy them pre-made. They're pretty cheap. In fact, I think I might even have a spare one I could loan to you.
I haven't even gotten to the point of...
And what you need to do is program the blaster to send out the right signal, depending upon what kind of box you have. And there's how-tos out there, you know, depending on which one you have.
Yeah. They get you.
Who get you?
The cable companies. They get you.
Oh, they're bastards.
They get you because they're like... Well, you know, for like a few dollars more, we can have a DVR.
Well, did you guys hear about what TiVo was doing? I have Dish Network, and my father gave me his old Dish Network recorder. And it's pretty basic; it's just a recording the shows and stuff, but it's integrated with the receiver. And I have it in one of my TVs in the house, and it works fine. TiVo sued Dish Network, okay, saying they had patent infringement, and they won the case in court. To try to slap an injunction against Dish Network to stop anybody who has these recorders from using them within 30 days. And they appealed and they got the injunction overturned. And they still have to settle, though. So they're going to be paying millions. Now, what I don't understand is all TiVo is a digital recorder, like a VCR. Instead of recording to a tape, you record it to a hard disk.
That's it.
How is that unique?
It's not.
They just took the patent out when they had the chance.
Exactly. It's the process that they use.
Patents suck, man. They really do.
It's the process that they use. That's how they were able to do it.
What are you going to do?
Hey, I got the 1 gig flash card for my new Kia.
Ooh.
How much you pay?
Wood shipping, $34.
It's not bad at all.
No, not bad at all. Came in like 2 days.
Man, I want one of them. That is a cool little thing.
And I dug up this program called Nokia-770. It's off the Mamo page, on it. That converts anything that M-Player plays, mm-hmm. it'll convert it into a format that the Nokia plays.
Awesome.
And so far, it works pretty good. I just got it this afternoon, so I fired off. I found the one program on my MythBox that actually wasn't a cartoon on it. So, but you know, the audio syncs up with the video just right. So it looks pretty neat. I'm ripping the
How long does it take to convert something like that, like a 700 meg file or something like that?
Well, I took an hour, a half hour show, which on the MythBox is about a gig,
right?
On it, and it took about 10 minutes.
Is that Metal Apocalypse?
Who?
Was it Metal Apocalypse?
No, I converted the Daily Show. Actually,
oh, the Daily Show.
It was the only thing I had on TV on the MythBox that was actually a real person. But I'm ripping a DVD now, so I'll see what that looks like. I'm curious to see what that'll actually
get. Oh, man, he went and said it. Ooh. The MPAA is going to be pounding at Alan's door.
I'm sorry, but it's for my own use, and fuck everybody else.
Oh!
What's their phone number? Report piracy? Where do I go to report that?
1-800-MPAA.
Don't they pay you like $5 for that now if you report it?
He's standing. He's sitting right in front of me right now.
Come and get him.
And he's ripping DVDs.
We'll take a picture of him with our camera phone.
Come get him and take his cohort Pat with him. The bastard. Speaking of DVDs, are we ripping DVDs of the TLLTS DVDs or something?
I still have some from last time, so we're going to bring them.
How many do you have from last time?
I've got maybe 40, 50.
Of the DVDs?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are we going to need to do CDs?
No, I don't think we're going to do CDs.
You don't want to do CDs?
We do DVDs.
I still have stickers.
Do we need more DVDs?
I don't think so. If you want, I'll bring a spindle with us. If we need to. I don't think we need to, though.
Oh, I forgot to have this
dum, 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 dum. He's still got his chopstick stuck in his hair.
So, Link, you were looking at some clients for Subversion, right?
I was.
Are we doing that this week, or was that...
We could do it.
Doing what this week? What? Who, huh?
Clients for Subversion.
Subversion clients?
I'll just give it a quick mention.
I was checking out some stuff with Subversion and looking at... I never used the GUI clients. You know, the last time I used one, it was... I can't even remember the name of it, but it was a really shitty client. Anyway, what I did this time was I was just looking around and I came across the ESVN is a GUI client and another one is called KDESVN. Just because, you know, a friend of mine, Mark, happened to mention that he wanted to start using Subversion more and he wanted a GUI client and stuff like that. But
Mark Stanley?
Yeah, Mark Stanley.
Wants a GUI client?
Well, for the people in his shop. You know? So I was looking around for that and I started using them and I have to say, you know, they come a long way and they work really, really good now. So if you happen to use Subversion for your versioning system. And by all means, if you don't have a versioning system and you do any programming, you probably should use Subversion. Check those GUI clients out. Again, they're KDESVN and ESVN. And I believe the differences there are you want the ESPN is like a generic one, and the KDE is built specifically for KDE, and the difference in the toolkits and stuff. But basically, it's almost like a file manager, right? You open them up, and you tell it what repository to look at, and you pull your little repository stuff in, and it makes the file tree, and you can pick files, and if you click on a file, uses your with the KDE SVN anyway, uses your file associations to bring up the correct editor and stuff like that. But it was really cool. You kind of like right click on the files and tell them to commit and update, and I was really pleased with it. It was neat. It was neat. So you should use them.
Cool. We'll have to check it out.
I like it.
And Dan, are you going to do your gimp tips, or are you going to save them for next week?
I'll do them after you answer my question.
Gimp. I'm looking. Hold on.
You're looking? I thought you'd have that.
Gimp.
All right. Are you done with your subversion stuff?
Okay.
All right. I got some GIMP tips. Actually, it was going to be a segment of the show called Demystifying the GIMP, but I haven't produced the audio for it yet.
Oh, you had audio?
No. I said I didn't produce it yet. And because, we get GIMP questions come across the forum, and I've seen a lot of people have GIMP questions, and I've always had GIMP questions. And I figured, since I use the GIMP a lot, and maybe I can pass on some tips to some people. And one of the questions that had come across the forum a couple weeks ago was being able to kind of draw in the GIMP, or draw like a line or something, or a box around a picture. Like, say you wanted to have a frame around a picture, or do some different drawing techniques in the GIMP. Now, the GIMP itself isn't necessarily a drawing application. If you're looking to actually do some artwork or graphics and drawing, I highly recommend checking out Inkscape or Spotty Potty, because that's basically what those applications are designed for, is creating vector graphics. But if you're going to, if you want to do some rudimentary drawing in the GIMP, you can do drawing. There's different techniques you can use, but you'll have a lot more success with those other applications. That being said, kind of what I want to talk about in conjunction with being able to draw is some different things that you can do with selections too, because the GIMP has pretty much a handful of selection tools. There's the rectangle selection, the elliptical selection, there's a free select, there's select contiguous regions, where if you click on something, it kind of, depending on the threshold that you set, will select what it feels to be part of that region. There's a color selectable to select all of that specific color, or depending on the threshold, different hues of that color. There's the scissor select, which allows you to basically create a outline by dropping dots on the screen in a pattern to create a customized selection. One of the things that you'll notice right off the bat is if you're using selection in the GIMP, by default the tools are set for free select, which means that you just draw your rectangle or your ellipsis on the screen itself, and the selection is outlined in dotted lines. What happens then is if you wanted to alter that selection, basically you're pretty much left to having to recreate it. I mean, you can add to it or subtract from it by creating another selection, but say you wanted to increase the actual length of the rectangle selection, or if you wanted to increase the circular selection, the selection tool itself doesn't have the capability of editing your selection. You have to recreate it pretty much. Now, there's another tool that allows you to actually go in and perform an edit on a selection, and that's the pathing tool, which is the same tool that you might want to consider using for creating drawings. When you use the pathing tool, which is pretty much on the same line, if you look in the GIMP toolbar, it's pretty much in the same line as the selection tools. This is the last one. It's got that little inkwell pen in there, and it's create and edit paths. Now, this is similar to creating paths in Inkscape or Soty Poty, because it is a vector graphic that it actually allows you to create on here. And you can export and import paths in the SVG format. So one of the easiest things that if you wanted to, you had a selection and you wanted to alter to selection, if you click on the pathing tool, one of the options at the actually at the bottom of the path, in the path dialog box, actually one of the options in the path dialog box, because there's the edit paths mode and there's a path dialog box, is an option to create a path from a selection. So once you create a path from the selection, like a rectangular path, and you choose that option, it will create that path and put the little endpoints on for the rectangle. Say it's a rectangle, and allow you to manipulate those endpoints. You can increase the, you know, you can move an endpoint so that you can increase the length, or you can increase the width, or you can create a trapezoidal shape, or, you know, pretty much do anything, or add endpoints in there by using the path edit tool. Three different modes: design, which would allow you to create a path. There's an edit mode, which allows you to change the different points on the path. And there's a move, which allows you to move the path around. Now, this is a handy feature to be able to convert a selection into a path and edit it. For instance, if you wanted to create a customized selection that you're going to apply across many different photos, instead of having to necessarily recreate that selection in the exact same spot and try and do it, you know, fiddle around with it every time, you can simply create the path of the selection that you want, save that path or export it out, and you can import it into your different pictures. And then you can use, under the pathing dialog box, you can then take a path that you've created, apply it to your image, and convert it into a selection. So you have that capability of going back and forth. It's a really handy feature for creating customized selections. Now, in conjunction with that, in the pathing tool allows you to create, like I said, a path on top of an image. Aside from converting a path into a selection, you could also stroke the path. So if you wanted to create like a box frame type thing over top of your picture, it's a simple thing is to come in here and select, you know, once you have your path, right, you stroke the path. Now, before you stroke the path, you want to make sure that you have the color that you want selected in the foreground color. And when you choose the option to stroke the path, it allows you to choose a brush, different endpoints that you want. If it's a polygon and has corners, it allows you to select the thickness of the stroke. So it's a really handy feature if you learn how to mess around with the pathing tool, creating paths. And actually, the pathing tool also allows you to manipulate points and curves using a Bezier curve system. Really handy. So, you know, that's something to check out with the GIMP right there. Of course, you know, once you start playing around with it, it's not as easy, you know, as just clicking and moving points around. You're going to have to learn some of the intricacies by playing around with it. Yeah?
You're interrupting Dan's thoughts.
No, he's talking about stroking.
There you go. So if you're looking to draw with the GIMP, or, you know, mess around with adjusting selections and everything, check out the pathing feature. It's really handy, and once you get it down pat, you'll be able to do some really, really nifty stuff with it.
And that absolutely.
The GIMP.
Now, are you going to write this up somewhere so that we can...
Hells no.
Because, you know, it's a lot easier if you write it up somewhere than if I have to keep going back and referring to the audio, because I never can remember how to make the, you know, how to do this stroke thing, and you make the you know, shapes that you can...
Well, what I actually, I've been wanting to do, but I just, you know, with all the crap that's been going on, it's not only did I want to write this up, but I wanted to do, you know, some screen recording of it.
Cool.
Show this.
Breaking into his Bill Cosby, like, you're going
to... I want to get some screen recordings going, and, you know, put up a little section on doing some of this stuff.
Yeah.
So... Playing around with, you know, pathing
and
the GIMP.
Jello.
So, you know, and actually, if you wanted to, like I said, it's an you can export the path out into an SVG format, pull it in Inkscape, and you can do some more advanced stuff with it.
I think Judlin uses Inkscape quite a bit. I think that's where he did the logo for us that he did.
It was in Inkscape, or did he do it in Blender?
He did some. I think he did it in Inkscape stuff too, man. I'll tell you what. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Listen, I want to make a plea and an announcement about our mirrors. We do need to have people mirror our shows for us. Because believe it or not, you guys eat up a whole shitload of bandwidth. A lot more than we originally thought. So if you're interested in mirroring the show, please contact me and let me know. If you are already listed as a mirror, please contact me. Hit me an email. Everybody, email me, you know, link@thelinuxlink.net or techshow@thelinuxlink.net be fine, or link@tllts.org even. Pick one, right? Hit me, because we have to do some new setup stuff. There are several mirrors listed on our site right now that are not current, and have not been current for some time, and there's a couple of them, like Jedi Moose and stuff like that, are just not even running anymore, so I'm just going to pull them off. Really would have been cool if these people would have told me that, you know, they weren't going to mirror us anymore.
The Linux Questions mirrors is pretty up to date, right?
Yes.
The MP3s.
Here are the mirrors that you want to go to, right? You want to go to the linuxquestions.org. You know, that's always been a great mirror. Gomer has an awesome mirror that he does for us. There's another one that I put into the rotation that's not listed on there that needs to go in there. Once we get that stuff in there and I get some of this stuff straightened around, I have it programmed up. I have the download pages programmed, and the RSS feed will be programmed to, you know, push the file request to a random mirror, to a random link, whether it be a mirror or be our site, on each file request, which is going to help us out tremendously. But I have to get a hold of these people around.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to ask you. How are we changing the RSS feed?
All you have to do is just make your link a little bit different, your file link a little bit different.
All right, because I'm like I said, the only reason why I ask is because we'll work with FeedBurner.
Yes, okay. You just have to use a different link for the enclosure. That's all.
Well, you just let me know what that would be.
I will.
Because that's the one that I was going to ask. I know you were doing that for the download. I didn't know if we were going to go through with the RSS.
Yes, it'll work for the RSS, and it's not going to be one of them things where it makes everybody re-download our entire archive either. It's just going to work.
Holy mackerel. When are we starting this?
Tonight.
Oh.
Tonight. Actually, it's been working all week.
On the RSS feed?
Not on the RSS feed. I've been beta testing that, but... It's pretty much the same thing as the download links that rotate, and we're going to be in good shape.
Fantastic.
Good shape. Oh, and the other thing, we need to have, if you can't help us with being a mirror, perhaps you might be able to help us by being a torrent server.
That's
for
right.
For our high bitrate OGS. I am already overextended with my server stuff at home. And none of the other three boneheads here have conceded to help us out by running the BitTorrent server.
I don't even run a server at home.
So we need to, if you're interested in hosting the torrent for the high bitrate,
Snakebite,
please give me a buzz. Give me a.
Dave talked about
email.
It on his last podcast.
Dan is my server.
Yes, for the Snakebite software. I looked at that. It's really nice.
It's a really easy way to get up.
Unfortunately,
a
it's not going to run on any of my stuff. So that's the suck part of it. But if somebody's interested in doing that, please let me know. And as soon as we get some people that want to do that, hey, you know, we will have the high bitrate OGS available once again.
What's the dealio with our situation now? I mean, do we have enough for the end of the month, or are we going to run over?
maybe.
One never knows now.
We're gonna find out. I think it's going to be cutting it close. That's why we really need to get these people running the mirrors to get a hold of us. Gomer, got to give me a buzz, you know?
Because I still have the colo. So, I mean, if we need to dump stuff up there.
Yeah. We'll probably be all right. I mean, I could make it still push to every damn thing over to the one mirror that I'm in control of too. So,
and but, we have the archive site too,
right?
How much bandwidth do we get a month?
750 gig.
And how much did we use last week? Up to now, how much did we use?
740 gig.
Let me
was that 250?
Let me look real quick, and I'll tell you what we have now. It's going pretty fast, a lot faster than I had anticipated, you know?
Well, after last week's show, we should probably see a third of that amount of traffic.
I don't know. We got some negative comments about last week's show, but we got a lot of positive ones, too. People saying it, you know.
From the perverts.
Yeah.
That's the funniest thing I ever heard, you know?
You should be right on top of this with this information.
Yeah, you should have. It's been a
on Monday night, they had a chat session for the Ohio Linux Fest. I jumped on there for a bit. It was pretty cool. People were talking about going.
And then they saw Pat, and then they were like, shh.
No. I announced we're going to have a Friday night get-together at Barley's, and some of the people were interested in coming. Cool. I sent out invitations to some of the speakers to come by Friday night. Everyone's welcome. So far, Chris DeBona said he's going to come down Friday, and Jeff Waugh, who's coming all the way from Australia, is going to pop into our little get-together Friday night.
Awesome.
So, haven't heard back from Matt Dole Cole yet, though.
313 gigs right now we're up to. And I fear that that would have been a whole lot more if I had not been right on top of the bandwidth thing after the last show.
And now how many downloads of the last show did we have?
Give me a second, I'll tell you.
Are you going to do Frapper Map shout-outs here?
We got a lot, man.
Start doing them now, 3 minutes to go.
Let me find where we were left off last time. We were at, what, 726 or so?
What?
What day was last week, 6th?
It'll be 7 days ago. Today's 13th, it'll be 6th, yeah.
Yeah, let's see. What do we leave off? Okay, I think I know where we are. Daniel Fry from Allentown, PA. Zhang Sang from... Hold on.
Got 10,000 downloads on the last show, not counting our mirrors. So
get out of here, really?
Yicheng China?
I swear, man.
Ryan Ruiz from San Diego, California. Philip Wett from Wigan, England. We've got Troy from Spokane, Washington. Yeah. Mark Tyler from Cairns, Australia. We got Paul from Medford, Oregon. We've got Zacharias from Flisa, Norway. We've got Antihero from Crescent City, California. RJZ from Perth, Australia. W. Centauri from Austin, Texas. Chago Cota from Vancouver, BC, Canada. Ben Rankin from Toronto, Canada. Jeff from Edmonton, Canada. Canada's coming in strong this week. James Lindsay from Briceville, Tennessee. Chris Aaron from West Texas. Steven from Oak Park, California. Elaine Staline from Austin, West Flanders, Belgium. Warren Sanders from Billings, Montana. Pedro Palhoto from Lisbon, Portugal. David Kay from Novi, Michigan. Michael Cummings from Fredericks, Virginia. P. Montadini from Canton, Michigan. And that's it for this week, people. If you're new to the show, please jump on Frapper.
What are we up to?
749, I think.
Cool.
Yeah, so
we're getting there.
Let's move it again.
Keep them coming.
If you're new to the show, please pop onto our Frapper map. Let us know where you're listening from. We like to see where everyone's coming from. It's cool. We appreciate it. Come hang out with us September 29th and 30th in Columbus, Ohio, for the Ohio Linux Fest. It's going to be a great time. We're really looking forward to it.
That's right. Everybody's meeting up at Joel's house.
We're meeting at Barley's, right across the road from the convention center Friday
right.
night. Have a little get-together. And
then we're all going back to Joel's house.
Then we're going back to Joel's house.
All drunk and rowdy and shit.
Sure his wife will appreciate that.
That's right. She's cooking, right?
She's yeah.
supposed to be cooking. Oh, we're staying at Gorkon's house.
Yeah, man.
That's awesome.
He said something about, you know, lasagna and, you know. Macaroni and cheese and potato chips.
You know, what a nice guy. He's going to let us stay.
Very nice
place.
Guy, man.
I'll tell you what.
Gorkon, thanks, man.
He's giving us Lenovos when we get there.
For me, he's giving me a Mac.
That's right.
Yeah, baby.
Yeah.
He says in the IRC, he says, link fuck off. That's funny. Everybody goes and trashes Gorkon's house.
The Waffle House is where we're going to
live. Oh, yeah. We're going to live in the Waffle House.
Yeah, man. It hit that.
All right, let me get the song and play us out.
All right.
Play us out.
Oh, next week we're going to have the Ohio Linux Fest guys coming on. Give us a preview of the festival. Should be good. This has been episode 157.
Yeah, it is. Good night, everybody.
Four stinking years.
Well, it's been 3 years.
Long time.
Start in year four.
You don't want to do that way.
How many who?
I had two windows running in for the X-Chat here. Typing quit in one of them quits in both of them.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Alrighty, we are playing a song by
that. Okay.
Gleam. Who's that guy that sent us the email today? There, Link. Was it? Yes.
Steve. Was it? Steve Bully.
Steve Bully, yes.
Yeah.
Is band
Derelict.
Called, is this band called Derelict, right?
Derelict, yeah, good stuff.
This is the song called Gleam.
Good stuff. In fact, let me.
Derelict, why don't you shout out, where can we find Derelict?
That's what I'm going to.
You can find him over at SBOS.livejournal.com.
There we go. I put it right in the GeoCities.
Or ca.geocities.com/chat. BOSINC at rogers.com/derelict. Just go to SBOS.livejournal.com. I guess that might be a little easier.
Yeah.
So this is
just follow the link in the IRC. That's even easier yet.
This is Gleam from Derelict. And how yo? Have a good one.
Bye.
Good night.
shut up. Just shut up.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush.
Damn it, why does that never play? Why does that never...
It's over.